This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Tyler Bridges, longtime Louisiana political follower, author of some outstanding books about our state, including Bad Bet on the Bayou and The Rise of David Duke, and a two-time Pulitzer winner. He's here to talk about what happened with the session, which closed last night with lawmakers agreeing to a $24.6 billion budget for the coming fiscal year. Also on the show, Ev Ehrlich. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs for President Bill Clinton, and he will talk about a few things, including net neutrality. On May 15th, the FCC proposed a new open internet rule. We'll discuss it with Ev, and we'll also hear from Renee Chatelaine of the Manship Theater. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number. We welcome your input. Also, you may reach us anywhere you are at 877-217-5757 or by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest to begin is Tyler Bridges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who spent many years in New Orleans and went off to Miami. And for the last several months, he's been trolling the halls of the Capitol, and the session ended last night at 6 o'clock with lawmakers approving a $24.6 billion budget. But along the way, there were a number of controversial items, some defeated and some embraced. And Tyler Bridges, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to see you as always. And last time you were on this show, we had Ben Nevers right before you, or right after you, I think. And he unveiled this Bobby Care proposal, which was something that he came up with after the governor and legislators rejected the expansion of Obamacare, essentially putting the governor's health care plan in a bill. And lo and behold, it got through the House, it got through the Senate, and now it's on the governor's desk. What do you think?
Well, Senator Nevers wanted the Louisiana to expand Obamacare, to use that phrase, and so he's obviously not a supporter of the governor's. I'm guessing that Senator Nevers is trying to create some mischief by saying to Governor Jindal, "Okay, well, you think this plan that you rolled out in Washington D.C. For the country, if it's so good, well, why don't we apply it in Louisiana?" And indeed, Governor Jindal didn't propose the legislation to have this plan take place in Louisiana. I did note Governor Jindal yesterday at a press conference. He, not surprisingly, said he was glad that Senator Nevers has changed his mind, which I don't think he has, and he's glad to see the bill become law in Louisiana. I think the real question then becomes, okay, Governor Jindal, you're actually going to begin implementing or trying to implement your plan here in Louisiana.
Well, the budget, which is almost $25 billion, has about $1 billion in non-recurring revenues, and that may be a conservative estimate. That has drawn some concern from lawmakers such as John Bel Edwards, the head of the loyal opposition in the House, a Democrat running for governor next year. And so next year, $1 billion will have to be found from other sources. So what does that do as far as creating some holes in future budgets?
Well, the phrase that I heard in the Capitol repeatedly, Jim, was that the governor and the legislative leadership are, you know, the proverbial kicking the can down the road. Governor Jindal only has one more budget to propose to the legislature. And what I hear is that he just wants to get through so he can focus his attention on his presidential campaign. Obviously, Governor Jindal would not agree with that statement. But as you mentioned, John Bel Edwards was raising, I think, important questions about, you know, whether the following year's budget will be in good shape because of the decisions being made this year. One thing we did not hear was the group that I wrote about a lot last year was the fiscal hawks, which is mostly Republican members of the House. Last year, they were very united. In fact, they were strong among themselves and united with Democrats to force changes in the budget. This year, there was no sign of the fiscal hawks. What I was hearing is that Republican leadership leaned on the members of the fiscal hawks to stand down. And so, for example, Lance Harris, a Republican from Alexandria, and John Schroeder, a Republican from St. Tammany Parish, we didn't hear the concerns they had expressed last year about the budget, the same kinds of things that John Bell was talking about this year. And so when the budget went through, John Bell stood up and raised concerns about, well, what are we doing this year? What's that going to mean for next year? But the fiscal hawks were absent.
297-5633 is your number. Now, last year, in an effort to generate some quick revenue, the state sold some office buildings, and that was an option that I don't think was used this year, but I did see that five states, including your home state of California, no longer have an operating governor's mansion. Perhaps we could sell the mansion. What do you think of that? That would generate some quick money, wouldn't it?
I'm actually a fan of a governor's mansion. I think it's a good place. You know, I think the governor should have a place to live with his family and be protected, and it's a place where events can be held. I mean, I don't get invited over there, but I think it does serve a notable function. I'm sure there's a lot more ways that the state could raise revenue.
Well, we sold others' office buildings, and I just have this a vision of Governor Jindal selling off the mansion, and Schwarzenegger and Jerry Brown have lived in hotels as governors of California at expense of their campaign contributors, not of the taxpayers. You know, the governor being a fiscal conservative, perhaps he could move a few blocks down Florida Boulevard to the Alamo Plaza, and he could walk into work every morning, and he could show that he is a man who truly knows how to count the beans.
Jim, what are the chances of that happening?
The chances of that happening are less than the chances of Governor Bobby Jindal becoming President Bobby Jindal on January 20th, 2017. And who knows? That may happen. But that's what is the elephant in the room regarding Louisiana politics right now. The governor was off in other places for much of the session, and you noted that. And he seemed to be a rather passive person as governors go for this session.
Yeah, the system in Louisiana is set up that if things are going to get done in state government, it's up to the governor. And some of that is because of the Constitution. A lot of that is just by custom. C.B. Forgotston and I have discussed this issue and he has pointed out that a lot of the things that happen in Louisiana are just by the legislature ceding control to the governor, you know, such that the governor basically picks the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House. So this year, when the governor does not have a very, very much of an agenda, then the legislature doesn't do much. And if you're happy with how things are in Louisiana, then that's a good thing. If you're unhappy with the education system or the health system or the roads, then you would probably be unhappy with what happened this legislative session.
Well, the session was certainly a session in which big business flexed its muscles in any number of ways, and the biggest way was scrapping the lawsuit against the oil and gas industry. Governor Jindal was highly supportive of this, was a catalyst to this particular legislation, and it overwhelmingly cleared both houses, and the governor at this point has not signed it. Is there any doubt that he will sign it at some point?
I was very surprised yesterday when I was at the governor's press conference in the Capitol, when the reporters had been invited to watch him sign what is Senate Bill 469 by Senator Brett Allon, which is the bill that would kill the New Orleans Levy Board's lawsuit. And he said, no, I can't, I'm not going to sign it yet because the Attorney General has asked me to review. He says the Attorney General wanted to review some legal issues raised by particularly a professor at Loyola University, saying that if this bill became law, then the state's claims against BP, billions and billions and billions of dollars, would be imperiled. And you wonder if the language that was put in that bill passed by the legislature also maybe some smart BP lobbyist or lawyer inserted some language in there without anybody realizing it. And that's what the Attorney General is looking at right now.
Yeah, that would be a much higher cost to the state if the BP money went away, and the governor, in an abundance of caution, is taking his time, and we shall see.
Yeah, and as a related issue, Jim, as you know, a lot of that money is supposed to go for protecting the coast. Bobby Jindal has, he did not want this. He does not want this lawsuit against the oil and gas companies to go forward. There's no clear way that the state has the money to pay for coastal restoration, which everybody agrees is so important for the future of South Louisiana. But the best possibility on the horizon is the expected billions of dollars that BP would be forced to pay. And so that perhaps there is, again, this law professor at Loyola who seems to know his stuff is saying, well, wait a second, if the governor signs this into law, those billions of dollars, again, I think most of it was meant for the coast, is going to be imperiled. And so I think this is it's a late issue that's come up. There's also some other issues. Mark Ballard yesterday of The Advocate raised a question, something called NOAA, which is a branch of the federal government. Money from them could be imperiled if this bill becomes law. So I think everybody thought this was going to become a law, but maybe there's a problem.
297-5633 for Tyler Bridges, two-time Pulitzer winner who spent much of his early career in Louisiana. It's hard to believe it's been almost a quarter century, but he was there for David Duke's political rise, which included one political victory 25 years ago over John Treen, and a couple of races that generated national and international attention in 1990 for the U.S. Senate and one for governor in 1991. And you're synonymous with Duke and Edwards in 91. And there's a question from William in Thibodeau about your thoughts regarding Edwin Edwards' quest to become a U.S. congressman. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there's an increasingly big field in that Baton Rouge-centric congressional race. State Representative Lenar Whitney from HOMA is the latest to join, and she is the state's Republican National Committee woman, so she perhaps has some strong backing from the state because of that. But I'm told that Garrett Graves has raised the most amount of money, which is very important, but it's a big Republican field. So whoever wins that undoubtedly will face Edwin Edwards. The state legislature drew that district specifically to elect a Republican, so it seems fair to think that Edwards will face a Republican in the runoff, and the odds that the odds are clearly that a Republican can win. But Edwin Edwards has won every single race in his career but one. And it's although it's been a number of years since he's run, I certainly wouldn't count him out entirely.
But right now, four Republicans of note in that race, including Whitney, Clater, Dietzel, and Graves. So in an open primary in which everybody's thrown together, and the thought being that Edwin Edwards would probably get, at a minimum, I would think, 30% of the vote, then that leaves 70% for all these other people to fight over. So it could be a very low number that results in somebody getting in a runoff, a low percentage, because 70% split four ways, and you got Rufus Craig, a Libertarian, who's in that race. There's some other people.
You got
people.
McCullough.
Yeah, there's some other people who are going to get some votes as well. Probably the other candidates will get over 5%, so now we're down to about 65% split four ways. So it'll be a fascinating battle royal for the 6th District.
And I think, Jim, we can expect those candidates to Republicans probably be all beating up on each other. They're not going to beat up on Edwards in the primary. So we'll see who emerges, and it could be somebody very bloodied.
And one thing to remember is that if Edwin Edwards, if elected, would be the last member of the greatest generation to serve in the U.S. Congress, the poster boy for the World War II generation. Edwin Washington Edwards. We'll be back in 90 seconds and go to the phones with Tyler Bridges. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number for Tyler Bridges. Worked for the Miami Herald for many years after being with the Times-Picayune during some interesting times, and he's back at the Capitol, and we'll talk about his latest venture and before we part company. But HB in Denham Springs, good morning to you. You're on the air with Tyler Bridges.
Good morning. Mr. Bridges, I don't really know exactly the proper way to word my question. The president's actions on emissions from industry, will that affect the average person in Louisiana insofar as the rates that they pay for electricity by his executive order, I think it was yesterday? Thank you, sir.
I think it's a great question, and I have absolutely no idea. It's never not something I've looked at. I wish I could provide a better answer, but I simply have no idea.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Professor Ed Richards writes, just heard Tyler say that everyone thinks that coastal restoration is a good idea for Louisiana. He writes, I've been researching this for several years as part of my climate change work. The Louisiana Coastal Restoration Plan is unworkable. Sea level rise means there is no coastal restoration that can work. It's just a plan to relocate other people's money to Louisiana. The end result will be further delay, retreat from the coast, increasing the deaths and property damage from future hurricanes. So that's an interesting observation from Professor Richards. He's basically saying we ought to get out while the getting's good, I think.
Well, the interesting question, Jim, is that is the state doing enough? And there's a lot of evidence that the state is not doing enough, and that particularly the legislators in the area that would be most affected, that maybe, you know, at some point in our lifetimes may be underwater on the issue of the levee board lawsuit. They sided with the oil and gas industry. So then the question is, okay, well, if they're not going to pay money to restore the coast, where is the money going to come from? And then that comes into the question now being raised by the Loyola law professor. Could the passage of the Senate Bill 469 that would try to kill the lawsuit, will that imperil the money from BP, which is supposed to go for the coastal restoration? But clearly in Louisiana, there's not a strong political will to do something about the coast. And I guess my fear is that it's that you know, it's the situation where you don't realize that something is a problem until it's too late.
Deborah Davitt writes, oh no, don't eliminate the governor's mansion. I failed to take advantage of access as a kid via my dad, so I still hope to get the chance to dress up, wine and dine with the glitterati at state taxpayers' expense. I did get to spend some time there, as always amazed that the trustees had free run of the place. That's from Deborah. How about moving the governor to the old governor's mansion? That would be a possibility, wouldn't it? I'm sure Carolyn Bennett would open her doors, and Governor Jindal and his beautiful family would be quite at home there on North Boulevard.
Well, I jog by it early in the morning as I did today, and I've walked by it at night, and I noticed they have a lot of receptions there. So the folks who have receptions there will have to go somewhere else, or maybe they go to the new mansion.
297-5633 for Tyler Bridges. Also, a big session, maybe quietly so by Louisiana standards. Usually, when we discuss abortion, we get really excited about it. But the Family Forum won on several abortion bills, and also scored on keeping an unconstitutional sodomy law on the books. So, Family Forum is a force to be reckoned with, and certainly one that Governor Jindal will not defy.
The striking thing for me, Jim, was that the restrictions that were passed by the legislature this year are similar to what happened in Texas. And as you remember, it was a huge, huge outcry in the capital of in Texas, in Austin, of these restrictions on the abortion clinics. And yet in Louisiana, where there's very, very little public concern, which I guess, shows where public opinion is, that this is a clearly is a is an anti-abortion state.
Marcia Shuler's column, or not column, but a story on page 2 of The Advocate today reads, "Bill to keep brain-dead pregnant women alive heads to Jindal's desk." This is another bill supported by the Family Forum, and it would mean that a pregnant woman on life support would give the unborn child a chance at life rather than pulling the plug on the lady if she is brain dead. This is a very sensitive issue, and I'm amazed it didn't get more attention.
Well, again, there is not a, you know, this is clearly a Republican state. Look at what happened in this legislative session. The big winners, I think, are big oil and big oil and gas, and efforts to expand the minimum wage for the working poor got nowhere. To expand Medicaid for the poor got nowhere. Efforts to tighten regulations on the payday loan industry did not succeed. And these efforts only would have succeeded if there was a strong public demand, and we did not see that.
Another story in The Advocate today, newly minted Common Core bill may face governor's veto. So even though Common Core survived the legislative process, Governor Jindal essentially says he has the nuclear option to kill it if he wants to. Do you think he will?
Well, that's an interesting question, Jim, because the people who would be his allies, who people are opposed to Common Core, don't trust his words. They're fearful that he's just speaking to a national Republican conservative audience by speaking against Common Core, and in the end won't do anything. But the time is drawing nigh, is drawing near, when the governor is going to have to make a decision one way or the other on the Common Core issue.
Okay. Mike asks about Treasurer Kennedy, who's been on this show a few times in the last month, twice, and he was pushing this bill to cut consulting contracts in the state. And a watered-down version of his bill has cleared both houses and now rests on the governor's desk. That would require anything above $40,000 to be approved by the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. The governor and the treasurer do not get along with one another. Will Governor Jindal veto this bill?
It's a great question. We don't know. You could argue it either way. One is that the governor has never pushed this idea because it's not a good idea, or he doesn't want to give any political credit to John Kennedy. But if he is a fiscal conservative, is the other argument, as he claims to be, then this is a way of saving the state some money.
297-5633 for Tyler Bridges in our remaining moments with him. And Tyler has been back in Louisiana for the last few years covering the Capitol. And Treasurer Kennedy is one who has been a proponent of funding for higher education and has noted on this show that over the last 6 years, which would be the 6 years that Governor Jindal's been in office, higher ed has been cut from the state budget from $1.6 billion to $500 million, a cut of more than two-thirds. It's a story that's been largely unreported, and as you noted about some of these other matters, where is the outcry? There may be some on college campuses, but the public at large, do they really care about higher education in Louisiana?
Well, that's a great question, given that the state traditionally is so low in the education rankings. Why over the years hasn't the public demanded changes to improve the education standard to get it at the state up to number 40 or 30 in the national rankings? And college students are usually among the first ones to protest, and we have not seen that. And one reason maybe is that the TOPS scholarship money has so many students on not paying for college at all, or paying just a minimal amount, that it's not an issue for them.
Johanna asks about the U.S. Senate race this year. You'll sure be covering the race that features Senator Landrieu against three prominent Republicans in Bill Cassidy, Paul Hollis, and Rob Baynes. How do you see it?
Well, it was interesting that it looks like the party, Republican Party, is falling into line behind Congressman Cassidy, although interestingly enough, Bob Mann raised the issue the other day of why the governor hasn't endorsed Bill Cassidy. But it seems clear that this will be Mary Landrieu's toughest race. She is, as you know, Jim, the only statewide elected Democrat, and the election could determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. So we've already seen money from the Koch brothers against her, and I'm sure there will be a lot more. So I'm guessing that she has an uphill battle to win another term, although how many years has it been since an incumbent U.S. senator last lost?
In Louisiana, it's in 1932.
I knew you would know.
So that would be 82 years, longer than Mary Landrieu has been alive, and not as long as Edwin Edwards has been alive, though, but 1932 is a long time. J.S. Broussard, I think, was the last incumbent U.S. senator to be defeated in Louisiana. But Mary Landrieu has eked out some close ones in the past, but this one may be a daunting challenge, most likely from Congressman Cassidy. You mentioned why hasn't the governor endorsed him. I think the reason is because Cassidy fired Timmy Teeple as his political advisor. Cassidy earlier had fired George Kennedy, who got him elected to Congress, by the way, by concocting this scheme to get Michael Jackson in the race with Don Cashew. So he fires Kennedy, he fires Teeple, and now he's running largely with David Vitter's campaign apparatus around him. And as politicians go, Vitter is very good. He's never lost a race.
Yeah, he's a tough campaigner, and we'll certainly see that even more so in next year's governor's race, when Vitter hopes to move from the Senate to replace Bobby Jindal and perhaps move into the governor's mansion.
Well, David Vitter next year will generate much national attention, and I've said it before. I think David Vitter, who is still a relatively young man, he's 53. He serves two terms as governor. He's 62, and then in 2024, there's another presidential election. We could have President Vitter succeeding President Jindal.
That's right, and that's kind of maybe up there with the governor mansion being sold, right?
Okay, but Tyler, you're moving away from the lens. What's going on with your current gig?
Yeah, I've spent the last 18 months since I returned to Louisiana working for The Lens. We're a nonprofit based in New Orleans, and we rely on contributions from individual donors and also foundations. And so as long as that money is rolling in, everyone's got a job. But I was informed last week that not quite enough money has been rolling in to keep me employed. So this is my last week with The Lens, Jim. I'm about to become a free agent. So I noticed your office looks a little untidy. So if maybe you got a job that I can help clean up or something, although I do hope to be based back in New Orleans.
Well, we hope you stay because you do it very well. And Tyler Bridges has the credentials to show for his work through the years, and thanks for your contribution today, and we look forward to visiting with you again soon. Take care.
Thanks, Jim. It's always fun to cover Louisiana politics and be here with you.
Let's do it again. Dr. Ev Ehrlich is our next guest, former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs under President Bill Clinton. He is involved with net neutrality as a fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute, a prominent Washington think tank, and he is the author of a recent report, Shaping the Digital Age, a Progressive Broadband Agenda. Dr. Ev Ehrlich, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Nice to be here.
Good to hear your voice again. Tell us about the concept of net neutrality. Who regulates it? Why should people care?
Well, there you go. The idea of net neutrality is that everything on the Internet travels at the same speed on the same terms and conditions. And to say it as simply as that sort of lays out the pros and the cons. On the one hand, it sounds democratic. It sounds, you know, everything's treated the same. On the other hand, it means that my cardiac monitor travels on the same conditions as an email of a cat playing the xylophone. And, you know, there are really very few other markets in the economy where the consumer can't pair up how much quality they want with what they're willing to pay. You can buy Starbucks, or you can buy Folgers. You can go to the post office and buy first class or priority. So that's really what the debate is about.
Well, last month, the FCC proposed new open internet rules, and the FCC proposal includes language that would reclassify the internet as a public utility. How would the public at large either benefit or not benefit from this?
Well, I'm not sure if it did that classification as explicitly as we're saying it. I worry about that. You know, people look at the internet and they think, well, this is really important, and they're right. It's incredibly important. But that doesn't tell you what to do with it. The idea that the internet should be a utility the same way that the phone system was or that the electric system was has problems. When we created the phone monopoly and created a rate-based regulation for it, we in essence said there's one way to make phone calls. You know, create a circuit, you close the loop, your voice moves around like electronic waves. And you can invest, if you want to build that system, we'll give you your money back and we'll allow you to have a certain rate of guaranteed profit. And in exchange, we'll figure out what the price is going to be. In the internet, right now, we have, depending on how you count, three, four, or more different competing systems. We've got cable, we've got fiber, we've got DSL, and more important every day, we have mobile, cellular, satellite. People show a real preference for mobility when they buy this stuff. So which of those systems are we going to turn into the utility? Right now, in fact, I think we're doing well because those systems are competing with each other, which is why internet speeds are increasing so quickly in the U.S. So I'm not sure how you take that kind of free-for-all among different technologies and say, well, we're going to treat them like a regulated utility.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the discussion with Ev Ehrlich, a former Undersecretary of Commerce under President Clinton, and he is a bullish broadband promoter. You believe there should be a progressive agenda. What would this involve?
You know, the most important thing about broadband and about the internet is the opportunity it creates for people. And if you're going to do that, then you've got to wire people up. Now, the main reasons why people don't get internet in the U.S., and surveys by government, by industry, all show this, is that they're not really that interested, and they ought to get interested. And I think that that is where the government role ought to be. We ought to be working to bring the internet into all schools, into all healthcare centers, into all local governments, and bring people in to this growing prosperity that's being created.
We'll return with Ev Ehrlich after this 90-second pause, 877-217-5757, the number that works wherever you are, or Inkster Show at WRKF.org on the World Wide Web. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Dr. Everett Ehrlich, better known as Ev, former Undersecretary of Commerce for President William Jefferson Clinton and a big proponent of broadband and the internet. And we're here talking with him about net neutrality and other matters. Ev says the broadband internet is transforming the economy, changing the nature of everyday life. Its construction and development requires large quantities of resources, and its existence generates substantial innovation and economic growth. Now, as expected, I've already gotten a few inquiries about Governor Jindal in Louisiana turning down over $70 million in broadband money from the federal government for Louisiana. He said that that was not money well spent by the federal government. Your thoughts, Ev Ehrlich?
I don't understand that. I think it's sort of what we need to do. You know, look, you've got parents out there probably listening to this show who drive their kids to a McDonald's parking lot to steal their Wi-Fi so they can do their homework. And that is not how we're going to build the next generation in the American economy. We've got to get over the barriers that stop people from participating on the internet, using broadband, receiving the training, the education, looking the opportunity to look for jobs or start businesses. This is really almost the avatar for the marketplace over the rest of our lives. I don't understand how you don't make accessing schools, education system, healthcare system a priority at the state, federal, or local level.
Zach on I-12. Good morning, Zach. You're on the air with Dr. Ehrlich.
I was wondering, because your guest had said that we shouldn't, or he was worried about what part of broadband, fiber optic, or was it 4G LTV, would be considered a utility. And then he said that we need to have schools and people who don't have internet, they need to get access. And so that's, in fact, treating it like a public utility. The fact that people nowadays have to they have to have internet connection to get a job, to have better themselves in education, I think it should be treated as a utility. And net neutrality, is what it's saying is that all information should have an equal footing, and it should, you shouldn't have to pay to get some information over other pieces of information. And I believe not having net neutrality will give certain big businesses a bigger foot control over.
All right. Your response. Thank you, Zach.
Well, first of all, I'm impressed that Zach knows what he's talking about, but I disagree with him about the impact of net neutrality. I think that it goes like this. There are some applications that require an uninterrupted signal, like remote medicine or remote education or entertainment or gaming. Those are really the applications that are going to be looking to get this high-speed lane and so on. It would be against the law and against what the FCC has explicitly said to actively slow down other content. It's a matter of allowing the signal to move from some of these sites uninterruptedly. I don't think that this would violate the underlying principles of the internet. In fact, it would allow it to achieve its real potential. And I would say this about utilities. I agree with Zach that in some sense I'm saying let's treat it like a utility if we're going to promote its use. But if we take it into the government sector that way, how do we decide which of these technologies gets investment? Where's that investment going to come from? The government can't find money to pay for food stamps, and yet we're going to need probably around $500 billion over the next 8 to 10 years to continue the investment we're making. That's going to have to come from private companies. So there are limits, I think, to the utility model.
All right. Logan writes, cable companies are monopolies taking advantage of the ignorance of those that regulate them. The U.S. already lags behind the rest of the world on internet speeds, and now the cable companies want to charge a premium for access. Simply put, writes Logan, nobody that knows anything about the internet is against net neutrality. Your response?
Well, I'm a little upset by Logan's demeaning my expertise, but I may disagree on a couple of things. First, the myth that the U.S. is slow. John Oliver showed some numbers the other night that I've heard about that said the U.S. was behind Slovenia and so on, and that it was 27th in the world. Now, the U.S. is 10th in the world. Number one is Korea, where the government has provided enormous subsidies. Number two is Japan, and the rest of the countries on that list are small countries with a big urban center where wiring up the quote-unquote country means running a line up the elevator shaft in an apartment building. Remember that when you see a number for Slovenia or Finland, you're talking really about the capital city because the internet hasn't fully extended itself into the hinterlands. In the U.S., We've got wide open spaces in suburban sprawl, and it makes it much harder and much more expensive to wire up the U.S. And again, the idea of neutrality is not that the cable monopoly, if Logan wants to call it that, is going to charge content to reach you. It's going to charge content a price if it wants to do so faster.
All right. One more call for Dr. Ehrlich from Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on the air with Ev Ehrlich.
Yeah. Good morning, Professor, and thank you, Jim. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the history of the Internet, was it not a DARPA, a defense, a government entity that that came up with the principles that the Internet is based on? I mean, the fact that we have it at all.
Absolutely.
Was that a government program?
Yep. It came out of DARPA, the defense. It was a way for researchers to share their papers.
Okay. Final question online from Lou Ellett asks, what about Congressman Scalise of Jefferson Parish, who is purportedly attempting to rewrite the 1996 telecommunications laws? Are you familiar with Representative Scalise's work?
Yes, and I understand that there is an attempt to rewrite the 96 Act, and the 96 Act ought to be rewritten at this point. In 1996, we knew there was an information superhighway somewhere down the line, and we had an old telephone system, and the regulatory system for it had broken down. So the 96 Act provided a transition to this new and more innovative world away from the regulated phone and to a free market to encourage investment. Remember, this didn't come from, you know, Tea Party wingnuts. It came from Clinton and Gore, the idea that you're going to need private investment to make this go. That's largely happened. And now we need to, I think, have a new legislative framework so the Congress exercises its control over what's going to happen to the Internet, where's the investment going to come from, what are the rules under which it's going to function. I think it's time to do that rewriting.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ehrlich. Good to talk with you, and let's keep in touch.
Jim.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're joined in studio now by Renee Chatelain, the elegant director of the Manship Theater, a person who's been around this town for some time as an exquisite dancer and a prominent lawyer. You have quite a varied background. Renee's been with us many times before, and she is here to talk about what's happening at the Manship Theater. And I see you've got the magnificent photography of Jack Mitchell in your hands.
That's right.
Is that Natalie Wood?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And
she
thank you
good.
For that wonderful introduction. Yeah, Natalie Wood's photograph by Jack Mitchell is just one of 30 pieces that we have on exhibit at the Manship Theater. And I'm, as you say, I'm a huge fan. In fact, the book that I have in studio today was signed by Jack Mitchell in 1998 when I happened to see him at a book signing. And, you know, his photographs are just iconic, and it's so wonderful, and we feel so fortunate that we are able to have his work exhibited at the Manship Theater in the gallery, because this is a curated work that has been touring the southeastern United States, and it's not something that will be seen by many people. I mean, the Thrasher Horn Center for the Arts actually owns the exhibit, and they're very careful with how it goes out into the world. So we feel very, very fortunate to have it with us through June 30th.
And he died last year.
See, yes.
November 7th, so his work is now being exhibited posthumously, and it is quite a body of photography. And Natalie Wood always looked good, but she really looks good in that photo. Do you know when that was taken?
This photo was taken, actually, I think in, well, I don't have the date. Oh, 1979.
Okay, 1979. So 2 years before she died. She would have been 41 in that photo, and she was definitely in her prime. Now, there's some other photos I've seen of him and John Lennon and Yoko Ono that he that he took that are iconic. Those were taken shortly before Lennon's death, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, we will have this week Tony Walsh, who was a personal friend of Jack Mitchell's and who Jack Mitchell confided in with the stories behind all these photographs. So you'll see Al Pacino, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and also lots of dance, lots of opera, authors, Kurt Vonnegut, and many, many other famous literary and artistic icons. And so he'll be here this week to talk about the stories behind the photographs, and this Thursday, both at 2 p.m. and at 6:30 p.m., he is going to have a slideshow and in the main theater talk about his stories and all the things that Jack relayed to him. You know, for instance, how tiny Natalie Wood was and how he decided to light her a certain way, how he simply walked around Alfred Hitchcock to take his pictures because he saw Alfred Hitchcock as a piece of living sculpture. And so he sort of moved around.
There
that,
was a lot
that
to
rather
walk
large
around,
man.
Wasn't
That's
there?
That's correct.
He, unlike Natalie Wood, was not a tiny individual.
Exactly. And so, and then, you know, also when I was growing up and dancing, as you said, this is pre-YouTube. And so all we did in between rehearsals was look at photographs and try to emulate. And he took all the photos of the really, really famous dancers. And so we spent our days as young dancers looking at those photos.
297-5633, your number in our remaining moments, and we're visiting with Renee Chatelaine, and the Manship Theater is a place where all kinds of things happen, and one of the world's best photographers of iconic people, Jack Mitchell, who died last year. He lived a long life. I think he was well into his 80s when he died. Yes, indeed. He was 88 years old. His work will be on display, and you say there will be a slideshow Thursday at 2 and at 6:30, is that correct?
That's right. And at 6:30, in fact, there's a new choreographer in the city who's just moved here, Mina Estrada. She's an independent choreographer and contemporary dancer, and she's created a work with dancers from around the community to pay homage to this exhibit because it does show sort of 20th century dance in a contemporary fashion. And so if you come to the 6:30 p.m. talk with Tony Walsh, it will be immediately followed by that performance, and it should be really stunning and a great homage to him.
All right, I'm seeing that Mitchell's portrait of musicians Lennon and Ono was used on the cover of the December 1980 Lennon Memorial Edition of People magazine. The photo was taken in Mitchell's home studio and published on November 9th, 1980, 1 month before Lennon, actually a little less than a month, December 8th was when Lennon was killed in New York City at the Dakota. But he was there and caught John Lennon at the time, just turned 40 years old. And looking at Lennon, he was a slightly built man. He was a larger than life musician, but a slightly built guy.
Right, and from what I understand, in that photo shoot was completely gregarious and humble. He and Yoko were just wonderfully patient, and Jack really relayed fondly to Tony about that entire shoot, and he'll talk about that on Thursday as well. But it's. I feel like we're going to get a very unique look at this exhibit, both because in the gallery you can view the photographs, but also the insight behind the inspiration and these stories about people that we really loved and looked at on the stage and screen for so many years.
Mm-hmm. John Lennon, he was 40 when he was killed in 1980, which means that come October, he would have been 74. I see that Paul McCartney will be celebrating his 72nd birthday in New Orleans. He's performing at the New Orleans Arena, I think now the Smoothie King Arena, on the 19th of June, a day after his birthday. But, you know, I'm sure McCartney will put on quite a show, and that is a pretty good arena for its kind to hear a concert. But when you get these people at the Manship with 325 seats, somebody like Arlo Guthrie is there. It really is an intimate setting.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so unique. There's just not another place like it. And, you know, this month we have Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits coming. And, you know, people, it's so intimate that people actually talk to the artist while they're in concert. We just had Los Lobos, and people were having conversations with the musicians as they went through the concert. There's really no other place where you can do that and feel that intimacy.
But it's hard to get big names to come to a small arena.
Well, we feel like we are doing the best we can with some really great names.
You had Rick Springfield there, right?
We just had Rick Springfield. That's right. And
with
then
17 top 10 hits.
You know, it was pretty amazing how crazy that audience went. It was, you know, the ages ranged from early 20s to, let's just say, over 50. And everyone was a screaming fan. It was really so much fun.
When's Arlo coming back?
You know, we're talking about Arlo coming back either in 15 or 16. 15 is our 10th anniversary, right, so we'll see.
And I had another question, and we got to do this one quickly, but Randy Newman, who performed for WRKF about 8 years ago, when's he coming back?
Look for 2015, our 10th anniversary. You'll see some stars coming back.
All right. Thank you, Renee Chatelaine. And Jack Mitchell, this Thursday, 2 o'clock, 6:30, The Great Photography from one of the masters. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.